Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome back to The Midpoint. Today I've got another special expert episode for you, and this time we're focusing on gut health with Dr. Megan Rossi. After studying dietetics, Megan went on to do a PhD in gut health and has since published over 50 scientific papers in international peer-reviewed journals. She's also been a leading research fellow at King's College London since 2015, and a lot of her work has been focused on the link between our brain and our gut. Megan could see that dangerous myths and fads online were negatively impacting people's well-being, but the groundbreaking research from her and her other colleagues wasn't reaching the masses. So she took matters into her own hands and in 2017 founded her own business called The Gut Health Doctor. I'm hoping we can tap into a bit of the insight she offers her patients today. So let's get straight to it. Dr. Megan Rossi, thank you so much for coming on The Midpoint. In your introduction there, I said one of the things that motivated you to really deep dive into this area and bring your information to the public was the myths and the kind of untruths and things that were just out there about food and about intolerances. And I imagine as a doctor who's researched and produced papers in this area for years, that must have been enormously frustrating.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was the fact that I was also seeing patients in clinic and they were coming to me, you know, with the best intentions, really wanting to make the most of this, you know, landmark scientific discovery about gut health. But they'd read a blog about, you know, being overly restrictive and cutting all these things out. And I saw this organ that clearly had so much incredible potential be, you know, misinterpreted and destroyed in front of me. So it was really that, like you say, kind of led me to get more into public translation of the research.
How did we get to this position, do you think, where almost every time you go out for dinner or you have a guest to dinner or you go somewhere, somebody has an intolerance, somebody is off something, somebody's decided to remove something. You know, this is definitely a sea change to 30 years ago. Is this environment, the way we're living now, is this the quality of food or is it awareness? Or is it a whole load of reasons that have kind of come together and created this?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think it's just a factor of we've got increased levels of food intolerances. I think there is this near like scaremongering that can occur via, you know, Dr. Google, blogs, social media, and those sorts of things, where it's actually starting to make people fearful of certain foods. For example, gluten. You know, we certainly know people who've got celiac disease or a very small subset have got gluten intolerance, which we think is like 3 to 6% of the population. But so many more people, whenever they eat something that's got gluten in it, like, you know, pasta, bread, etc., they have this fear of it. And we see it in clinical trials all the time. It's called the nocebo effect, a little bit of a sciencey word. But essentially, if you believe that you're ingesting something that is bad for you, you can physically manifest symptoms. And it comes down to this two-way communication that occurs between your gut and your brain. And, you know, it's not that people are crazy. You know, it happens to all of us. It's a protective mechanism that our bodies develop. So, you know, if you have food poisoning to maybe it's fried rice or something, often people can never eat the fried rice again, even if they know that the batch is never going to, it's not going to hurt them again. It's just because of that mechanism, that fear. So actually this nocebo effect, I think, has elevated these kind of awareness and near fear of certain food intolerances. But of course, yes, there is, you know, the subpopulation absolutely do have food intolerances. And I think there is that growing awareness there and therefore they're able to manage symptoms. Whereas before, maybe they just didn't tell anyone that they were having, you know, bouts of diarrhea or really bad bloating and things like that. So it's a bit of a cloudy mix of it all, I think.
So if only 3 to 6% of the population actually have a gluten intolerance, but many more are wanting gluten-free food, is there something about those foods that they think are an unhealthier, you know, it's an unhealthier version if you have the version with gluten? You know, put us straight on that. If I had a piece of gluten-free toast and then I had a whole grain piece of toast and there's nothing wrong with me, I've got no intolerances, which one's healthier?
Look, Gabby, you know what? If we actually look at the nutrition quality of it, it's going to be the whole grain, you know, even sourdough, which contains gluten. So gluten is just a protein, just like things like, you know, peanuts have proteins in it. A lot of people want protein, right? But there has been this media campaign that gluten is really bad. And like I said, yes, in those subpopulations, you know, it can cause, you know, intolerances and things like that. However, actually, it really forms an important property in things like bread to help it get that nice doughy texture. So the gluten-free bread, what they do to kind of emulate that is actually add in a whole lot of food additives to it. Often it's got more sugar in it, less fiber, and less protein. So they've actually done clinical, or not clinical, but observational studies where they've got all of this data comparing the gluten-containing variety and the non-gluten-containing kind of processed variety. And they've shown, you know, that. So indeed, this version is going to be much healthier in terms of, you know, those basic principles of more fiber, less added sugar and things like that.
There is also, it feels like a kind of a reaction to things like the Atkins diet. Do you remember that? Where people had to cut all their carbs out. That if I cut gluten out, I'll also be cutting carbohydrates out. But clearly we need carbohydrates in our diet. Are you finding this as well when patients come to you, that they're confused about carbohydrates these days?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I understand it because, you know, if I ask my friends and family, you know, very intelligent people, they have been led to believe that the carbohydrates are really bad for them, particularly if they want to look at weight management. But that's just not the case. In fact, dietary fiber, so that essentially is the backbone of all our plant-based foods that feeds, you know, those trillions of bacteria in our gut, and therefore is incredibly important for things like weight management, hormone regulation, and things like that. Actually, fiber is a type of carbohydrate. So people who actually cut out carbohydrates from their diet, what happens is actually they reduce down the types of these gut-loving fibers. And studies have shown that people who cut out carbs when they actually, you know, don't necessarily need to, actually have higher risk of type 2 diabetes, seem to be of a higher body weight in the long term, and some higher risk factors for certain types of cancers as well, because we know that there is these types of fibers in these carbohydrate foods, you know, like the whole grains, things like quinoa, buckwheat, oats, that actually you can't get from other sources of food, that's really protective and beneficial for your overall health.
And you mentioned is good for the gut. So let's talk about guts, gut lining, gut health, and microbiome, probiotics, you know, these buzzwords that are becoming more and more in the vernacular. I'll tell you my personal kind of interest in this grew about 5 years ago. I met a woman locally who'd started making pressed juices. And when we got talking, she suffered from depression when she was younger, and she'd looked into her own health and realized that her diet was a big factor for her. And she really went deep into gut health and improved her mental health through what she was eating, basically, and working on her gut. And, you know, the gut is called the second brain, isn't it? And she truly believed that, you know, that was a big factor in her improving her mental health. And I really felt this was, you know, kind of going to be kind of a big breakthrough area in health and addressing mental health, because it was all to do with the inflammation of the gut as well. And it just doesn't seem to be kind of punching through yet, does it? In the way that, you know, you think, well, this makes perfect sense. And why is that, do you think, that we're still not kind of really being able to get this message across?
Look, it is a really challenging one, but I think just to echo what your friend or the person that you met kind of observed, we actually, again, I'm a scientist, so I always want to highlight that there is robust scientific evidence that highlights.
Yeah, so go on. I should have asked you that first. Tell me the science then of why it worked for her.
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that there is that two-way communication between the gut and the brain, and there has been fascinating, you know, clinical intervention studies where they put people on this gut-boosting diet, and that essentially just has all different types of plant-based diversity. So you've got your whole grains in there, things like your chickpeas, as well as some animal foods like oily fish, fermented dairy like live yogurt, you know, nuts and seeds, and all those really good beneficial foods. And the other half of the people who had moderate severe depression when they randomized them to this trial actually had a befriending type of counseling. And they compared, so this gut-boosting diet versus befriending counselling. They followed them for 12 weeks, giving them either of the interventions. And what they found in the diet group, but 32% of them had a significant improvement in their depression scores, which would have classified them as no longer clinically depressed. And in that counseling group, it was only about 8%. So we do actually have really unbiased clinical trials to show that diet has a huge impact. But I always like to make the disclosure that everyone in that study actually stayed on their antidepressant medication. So certainly if anyone's listening to this thinking, you know, I've got depression, I want to, you know, really work on it, certainly never go cold turkey on medications. What I recommend is, as an addition, focus on, you know, that gut-loving diet. And then perhaps over time, and certainly I've done this with a lot of prescribing doctors and patients who've really wanted to come off the antidepressants, we've actually been able to tailor that off via, you know, focusing on that element. So I hope people feel really empowered by this sort of research. But you're right, it has kind of lacked a little bit of that translation. And I think a lot of it comes down to the fact of, you know, perhaps our food supply, right? You know, we all live very busy lives, and it can be quite confusing when, you know, you want to go to the grocery store and you think you're having something really, you know, healthy, but actually it's still quite ultra processed, like these vegan burgers and, you know, vegan sausage rolls. And you think, well, plants are good for me and good for my gut, therefore I should be having these. So actually, I think a lot of the kind of the steps of what a gut-boosting diet has been kind of confused, and perhaps food industry is supporting that in a way, because it means that people are continuing to buy those sorts of foods. But I think the fundamental principle is that we know that there is these six different groups of plant-based foods. Now, Gabby, I'm going to quiz you on your knowledge of these super six, I like to call them. What do you think the six different categories of plant foods could be?
So would vegetables be
that's one group?
Yep. Yeah. Nuts and pulses?
Perfect. Yep.
Is that one group?
I would say nuts and seeds is one group, and then, pulses are another one. So you have three. Then, this is the best I think I've ever had, Gabby.
Do we use beans? Is that, or does that come under pulses?
That's under pulses. Yeah, beans, legumes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we've had what else?
Fruit.
Oh gosh, fruit. Yeah. Do you know what though? I'm just not a fruit person, so I always forget about fruit because I'm a vegetable person. Fruits, okay. Where else are we going with this?
Whole grains.
Right, so whole grains, right.
Yeah. So whole grains are things like your oats and your barley and those sorts of sourdough bread and stuff like that.
Okay, okay. And then we've got one more.
What is
chocolate?
The final
I'm joking. What's the
But you know what? No, actually, dark chocolate has these amazing types of polyphenols and types of plant chemicals in them.
Yeah.
So actually, we do count it. So the third group is herbs and spices. So I would count dark chocolate kind of in that group, where actually it does have some benefits.
So herbs and spices, that's interesting. And have they got to be fresh herbs and spices?
No, they don't. Not at all. So we know some of the highest kind of antioxidant foods are actually herbs and spices because they've been condensed down. Mm-hmm. So there is those six different categories. So
go on, say the six again.
So fruit, veg, whole grains, herbs and spices, legumes, nuts and seeds. So six categories. And I want people to think about, have they had something from each category most days? Like today, for example, are you missing out on one of those groups? Gabby, like you said, you're not that into fruit, which is absolutely fine. But that might be your slight area of weakness when it comes
to gut health. Bizarrely, because I needed a quick breakfast, I had a kefir yogurt with berries and nuts and seeds.
Perfect.
And then I grabbed a banana. So I've actually had more fruit today than I normally have. but yeah, that's kind of takes care of quite a few different things there, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's why, you know, the principle of gut health is about trying to get in that plant diversity, because each different of those super six categories actually provides our bacteria with different fertilizer. So if we just get all our nutrients from whole grains and fruit, then we're actually going to miss out on a lot of the other types of fertilizer, which feeds the different type of bacteria that might look after things like your skin health and your hormonal health and your mental health. So you need that combination. So literally, if people take one thing away from this, I want it to be for them to think about those super six and trying to get something in most days where you can.
Variety is the spice of life. Variety in diet, it just seems to be the message as well that needs to get across in terms of, you know, the amount of vegetables that you eat. It's not just having broccoli every day, it's having different vegetables all the time. And I first came across this kind of concept, if you like, about 5 years ago, and I started working with a new personal trainer, and he asked me to record all my foods over 5 days, and he wanted there to be 50 different types of food across those 5 days. And he didn't really quite explain why at the time, but then afterwards we talked about that to do with, you know, the gut. And that seems to be, I think, also something that's coming through as a message to people, you know, that it's, because it used to be your five a day, didn't it? It was the message about fruit and veg. But actually, it should be five different a day almost, shouldn't it, in terms of variety?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, again, coming back to the science, they've done clinical trials where they showed that people who eat at least 30 different types of plants a week have better gut health.
That's a big day.
Yeah, than those who eat the same 10 on repeat. And I think a lot of, you know, typically healthy people I see actually, because they're so busy, they just eat the same fruit and veg on repeat and grains, and they don't know about this concept of diversity. And the reason why this diversity thing, as you've highlighted, is really only very new because we've discovered the microbiome. Before, we didn't really understand it. And that's why, you know, the outdated message of the, you know, just have your five fruit and veg a day and not really focusing on diversity, you know, was the key message. But that's starting to translate into actually also think about diversity because we've discovered the importance of diversity for our gut microbiome.
So the gut microbiome must be quite clever then, because it begins to recognize this is the same thing you're giving me here. You're not challenging me. So we're having to effectively challenge our microbiome, are we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is more of these microorganisms, and mostly they're bacteria, but actually we have some beneficial viruses, even parasites and fungi living within our gut. And that collection is called our gut microbiomes. It's a bit of a sciencey word, but that is kind of what we're referring to. And you're right, they need that diversity to thrive because there's so many different types. You know, there's over, you know, 40 trillion microorganisms in our gut, and the subtypes like different varieties. So like if you're just feeding them the broccoli, then the bacteria that like the cauliflower and the oats actually they can't grow very well. And therefore the skills that they possess, which can be quite powerful in terms of producing different hormones and vitamins, actually those bacteria die off and therefore we lack those skills. So you kind of think of it like a sporting team. You know, you don't just want all your forwards and don't just want all your backs. You want that really diverse range of skills and therefore you need to feed them that diverse range of nutrients.
And so how clearly can you as a scientist and your fellow scientists mark out the kind of links then between those? What kinds of diseases and illnesses are you seeing when gut microbiome is not working properly or has not been fed properly?
Yeah, this is a great question. And there's been many clinical trials. So I work as a research fellow at King's, but, you know, researchers all over the world, whether they're looking at, you know, sports performance, whether they're looking at cancers, whether they're looking at metabolism, are all starting to focus on the gut microbiome because it seems to be this missing link. You know, we've always been looking at human genetics of how we respond to different diet and lifestyles and disease risk. And we didn't understand about the bacteria until technology allowed us to see what's there and what they're actually doing. So everyone is starting to look at the gut microbiome, and you know, it is discovering some, you know, incredibly fascinating things. You know, over 70 different chronic conditions have been linked with an unbalanced microbiome. Now, it's very important to highlight, I guess, the different levels of evidence. When I say linked, it's a case of, you know, for example, people who have depression seem to have a different type of gut bacteria than those who don't have depression. But just looking at those observational studies, we don't really know, is it a chicken and the egg? Is it a case of, you know, people with depression seem to eat differently and therefore that feeds different bacteria and that's why there is that link? Or actually, could it be certain types of bacteria that are actually predisposing people to depression?
So you could be born with, you know, a predisposition to have depression, but your diet could exacerbate it.
Absolutely. And that's kind of the next stage of those intervention studies. And we referenced the study before about people who went on that gut-boosting diet and those in the counselling group. And that's the intervention study that we need to say, well, actually, it looks like the bacteria have a causal role in this.
Right. And so would that natural kind of the natural progression of that be to start kind of, you know, testing the feces of a baby to see what the gut biome's doing in a baby and then monitor through their life? Is that how you're going to get that link?
Yeah, so they have absolutely started to look at the different microbiomes and how it changes over time, but also looking, like I said, at people with the different types of conditions and intervening on them through their gut and seeing whether their condition actually improves or not. So that's kind of what the stage of research we're currently at. So whether it's things like dementia or Parkinson's disease, what they're starting to do is intervene on their gut health through things like the Super Six, you know, getting people to go on these diets and having a look at whether that improves some of their symptoms of their condition. And in some cases, it's looking really positive. Other cases, it's looking to be a little bit more complex than that. And I think that's probably that interaction between things like our human genetics and the gut microbiome, and the fact that the microbiome is still very much a new science. So what, you know, I recommend is people probably don't waste their money on getting these fancy microbiome tests just yet. We certainly do in our research world, you know, we do microbiome tests, but the commercialization of that hasn't quite happened yet in terms of like the detail that we really need to find out meaningful results. So I would save the £200 or whatever they're costing these days, spend it on those super six, and probably wait 5 or so years until the research catches up. So therefore, when you get these tests, it has more of a clinical meaning, and we can therefore, you know, have personalized recommendations. But we're not quite there.
Not quite there yet. I mean, and this is talking to you about kind of disease in the gut, and obviously what can happen in the future. I imagine it's very exciting because this will also change the way medicines are formulated, presumably, and you know, because we're not going to kind of get rid of orthodox medicine, but most people would like to prevent having to go on to drugs, wouldn't they? They'd like to prevent having a life on medication. So knowing about your super six as early as you can in your life and helping your gut microbiome is where you're coming from at the moment, because this is your books around this, isn't it? The book you have out.
Yeah, so I've got a couple of books. So Eat Yourself Healthy was very much about helping people get on top of digestive issues, you know, things like food intolerances, bloating, constipation, reflux, and looking at other lifestyle factors as well as all the recipes. And then, you know, from that book, I was really proud of that first one. People were like, okay, great, I'm feeling good within my gut, but I now know my gut is linked to things like, you know, menopause, it's linked to my mental health, it's linked to my skin health. How can I enhance my gut health? And that's essentially what Eat More Live Well is all about, looking at those kind of small wins we can do, including things like the super six and the recipes, to maximize people's gut health. And Gabby, you mentioned about medications, and I think it's a really, you know, exciting realm where actually we're starting to appreciate some of the mechanisms of how certain medications work actually is via our gut microbiome, that we didn't quite understand before. We knew this medication worked, but we didn't understand why necessarily, the mechanism. And now we understand actually it's because it's impacting our gut bacteria. And we're even looking at why some people get bad side effects to certain medications and other people don't. And we think some of that comes down to the different types of microorganisms. So particularly in cancer therapy at the moment, they're actually looking at using the microbiome to predict response to different types of cancer therapies and helping people triage that way. So yeah, there is so much exciting research coming out to really help inform not just the prevention, like we mentioned, but also the treatment and management.
And you just mentioned the menopause word. Obviously, the midpointers would probably be jumping up going, oh, okay, what should we be eating then? So what are the kind of things that you recommend for people who are in perimenopause and menopause, and how are you seeing that impact them?
I think it's a really important time for people to start to focus that little bit extra on their gut health when people are going through the menopause. And I guess mechanistically, what we know is that our gut bacteria actually produces a certain type of enzyme which can help recycle estrogen from our gut and put it back into our blood. So actually, our bacteria are really, really important in estrogen regulation. And that's why we're seeing that certain types of ways of eating. So one study included, I think, close to 17,000 people going through the menopause, showed that those who ate more plants in their diet, again, doesn't need to be plants only, you can still have oily fishes, hugely beneficial in the menopause, but actually those people seem to have, you know, a reduction in things like hot flushes, difficulty sleeping and things like that. So we do know that, again, getting in those super six actually can be really important for helping those menopause symptoms. And also another study showed that females who were going through perimenopause, they could delay the natural menopause by having oily fish and legumes on a regular basis. So again, we know that both of those foods actually really help nourish the gut bacteria. So it makes sense that they're probably supporting the bacteria that are recycling that estrogen.
If you have had, you know, women have had any kind of eating disorder earlier in their life, if they'd had periods of anorexia or bulimia, or, you know, just general kind of, you know, denial or been, those things all affect the gut, don't they? Clearly. Is it possible to repair it to a state that, you know, when you do get to perimenopause, you can have a normal process, as opposed to kind of you're always behind, if you like, you're always behind the curve because of your previous behaviours?
Yeah. So the good news is you absolutely can help, you know, rejuvenate some of the bacteria that perhaps may have been lost or damaged through that overfood restriction. But, you know, I want to be really open and honest and say it depends, I guess, how long you've had the eating disorder and how much potential damage has been done. But there are obviously those steps you can take if you're having the super six, if you're having things like fermented dairy, if you're having things like, you know, kimchi and sauerkraut, certain types of fermented veg, oily fish, those sorts of things. You really are doing the best that you possibly can in terms of repairing that gut. But I would say if anyone's kind of just come out of an eating disorder, it is a slow process because your gut is this big muscle. So your gut is actually 9 meters long, which is pretty crazy if you think about it, coiled up in each and every one of us. And it's this big muscle. So, you know, when you have eating disorders, you know, you lose muscle throughout the whole body, including your gut. So it can become more sensitive and therefore it takes a while to be able to build back up on things like plants. And you know, that's similar to food intolerances where people have gone on these very restrictive diets because they think things like beans and legumes and garlic and onion don't agree with them. And perhaps it doesn't in the short term because they've got a sensitive gut, but actually it's really important to start rebuilding your tolerance to these types of foods because they are what we call prebiotic. So they fertilize the good bacteria. So they're important to have, but is that fine balance of like retraining your gut, like you would retrain your muscles. You're not going to go do no exercise for like, you know, 2 years and then hit the gym really hard. If you do, you're going to have really sore muscles. The same with your gut. You know, if you don't have
so
a lot of
drip
foods,
feed those foods back into your diet and build up the tolerance to them.
Absolutely.
And because a lot of people do say that, don't they? Oh, it doesn't agree with me. So you can get to a stage where it agrees with you. Is that what you're saying?
Certain types of food. So things, the most common food intolerance is lactose intolerance. So that's milk sugar. So you find it in things like really soft cheeses, milk, cow's milk, for example, ice cream, custard, those sorts of things. And that in some populations can affect up to 90% of people of Asian, African, Caribbean backgrounds. And that's because as people age, they lose this enzyme called lactase enzyme, which is needed to break down the lactose, that milk sugar. And therefore, when they have these foods, it gets malabsorbed and then creates things like bloating, diarrhea, and altered poops and things like that. So in that population, there is a little bit of evidence to highlight that if you include small amounts like 50 mils of milk on a daily basis, it teaches your bacteria to how to kind of metabolize it for you. But still, there's always going to be a cap that you can have because you are lacking that specific enzyme. However, the other types, they're not actually food intolerances, but they're more food sensitivities that people experience, like garlic and onion and legumes, like your chickpeas, butter beans, and your veggies, so to speak. That's more because of the types of fiber they've got in them. And it's the bacteria that eats the fiber. So in those scenarios, absolutely, you can train your gut to be able to tolerate them and get to a place of, you know, enjoyment. But it can be a slow process. So a lot of my patients who historically had suffered with things like IBS, what I recommend is literally, it's painful, but a tablespoon of legumes, so chickpeas, butter beans, any of those on a daily basis for the first week. Second week, you build it up to 2 tablespoons and you keep going. So you just get one of those cans, have it in the fridge so it's not, you know, too burdensome. You don't need a soak and all that sort of stuff. And then you slowly, after over about 3 months, build up your tolerance to it. So that's the sort
they're
of
the
process.
Things that they think they don't want. They think their body doesn't need, you know, or that's the thing that they're associating with the bloating. So it's counterintuitive almost for them to be doing that. But you can see why scientifically it would then work.
Yeah, they're the prebiotic foods, so they are important to have.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Okay. This feels like a good time, Dr. Megan Rossi, to bring in a few questions from the Midpoint listeners. You've already answered a few, actually, within the conversation we've just had. For example, Kate Johnson, 644, wanted to know things to add into the diet for gut health. I think we've got the Super Six right there. I think that's the answer to that one. But this is a good one, and it feels a bit 90s, this. Colonic irrigation. Good for the gut or not? A wisdom for working mums asks.
Brilliant one, because again, it's something that a lot of people are starting to do because they think, oh, it makes sense to clean out your gut.
It seemed to happen. Like in the 90s, it seemed to be a big thing and then it went away and it's coming back.
And it shouldn't necessarily be coming back. But a lot of people that I see in clinic who suffer with constipation find that having these colonic irrigations flushes everything out. So yeah, they feel good for about 7 days after, right? But what that can do is there's not any risk factors of things like penetration of, you know, the water and the power through your intestines. So there's a lot of risks attached to it. But also you can't necessarily control which types of bacteria then refertilize and re-go. So in some people, actually, they can develop things like IBS after it because the types of bacteria is imbalanced. So for people who are struggling with constipation, I understand the temptation because you love that emptying feeling and that cleaned feeling, but your gut can also get quite addicted to it. And you don't want to be stuck in a place where you have to have these irrigations ongoingly because of those associated risks and costs and hassle and all that sort of stuff. So there's many other, you know, strategies out there that, you know, science backed that can really help you get on your top of your constipation. So eat yourself healthy. I've got this big flow diagram there. So it's things like obviously checking fluid and fiber. That's the first one. But a lot of people go, yeah, I'm having plenty of that. But the next step is actually looking at things like the types of fiber. So psyllium husk is a really helpful laxating type of fiber that I recommend people have, about a tablespoon, and you can build that up again. That's really powerful for constipation. But then there's things like your pooping position. So I've got some diagrams there, which actually can be a game changer. So some people, it's not about their diet. It's actually about their pooping position and how they've kind of been taught. And that can help, you know, leverage things. And then also things about this pooping fear. So our bowels are very sensitive. People may know that if they have to go poop at a friend's house, you know, they can't poop anymore. Their daily habit goes out the window, or on holidays and stuff like that. So we talk about those sorts of strategies around the gut-brain axis and supporting this movement called the mass movement, which pushes the poop out and stuff like that. So there is plenty of science-backed strategies for constipation. So try them. Be very cautious with these colonic irrigations.
On pooping and the amount of the amount of times we visit the bathroom, what is the kind of optimum for people? You know, if they, I know obviously you shouldn't be going, you know, a day without going, but
well, no, not necessarily, actually. That's a bit of a myth, Gabby. That's a really good one. So what we see is normal for pooping, right, is you should be going at least 3 times a week and no more than 3 times a day. So there's such a big gradient as to what normal is for people, because some people just have differences in their colonic motility, their gut movements, right? So actually 3 times a week, you know,
so 3 times
okay.
a week
is
you
okay
shouldn't be going to the doctor and saying I'm
if it's if it's not causing any sort of grief for you and that's normal for you, absolutely fine. If you're going less than 3 times a week, then it's like, okay, yes, we need to kind of intervene on that, look at what's going on. And then up to 3 times a day. So if you're going more than 3 times a day, so more of the diarrhea, you know, frequency, you might be incomplete evacuation of your bowels when you do empty, and there could be other things like prolapses going on and stuff like that. So any more than that, then again, it's worth having a chat to your GP just to kind of look if you can get on top of why that frequency might be happening.
Excellent. Okay. And Mummy Exhausted. That doesn't sound like a good name, does it, for an Instagram name?
I mean, Mummy's always exhausted, aren't we?
Yeah, I hope she's not too exhausted. What are the best foods to heal your gut? Well, you've kind of told us that, actually, with regards to IBS and other things. Is there anything else you want to add in there?
Yeah, I would say that the focus is very much on inclusion, not exclusion. And I think people very much fall into that trap of being like, okay, I need to heal my gut so I can't have any of my favorite foods. I can't have any of this or any of that. And we see that's actually not the case. If you're getting in your Super Six, if you're getting in your 30 different plants a week, you know, having a little bit of white chocolate in there is absolutely okay. I think that's an important kind of principle to add, you know, when people are thinking about healing their gut. And the other one is if you have, for example, had like a bout of, gut infection or, you know, chronic like diarrhea or something because you've gone away and got a stomach bug or something like that, then it is a case of actually going really easy with reintroducing the Super 6. Don't just slam it really hard with all of this high fiber, because the thing about fiber, and we've kind of touched on it, is that yes, it's food for your gut bacteria. So actually, if we think about our gut, it's at 9 meters. Most of our nutrition gets absorbed high up in our guts, the first, you know, 7 or so meters. So things like our protein, most of our fats, and a lot of our digestible carbohydrates, so a lot of the pasta and rice, gets absorbed up there. But anything which humans don't have the enzyme for, like fiber, human cells can't digest fiber, goes to the final part, to the 1.5 meters at the end where the bacteria mostly live. And they then have the enzymes to break down that fiber and things like that. So if you've got a bit of a sensitive gut at the moment, I wouldn't say go load it with fiber all at once. It's that slow, mm-hmm. gradual reintroduction, particularly after an infection or something.
Right. And how soon, says Joss.kin72, is a reaction from eating something to discomfort IBS related?
Yeah, if I've just eaten a berry and I'm getting gut symptoms straight away, is it the berry's fault or is it something else? Because a lot of people say that they're trying to always pinpoint what it is that's causing them to have those symptoms. And I think what's important to highlight here is there is this thing called the gastroclonic reflex. So for example, in the case of IBS, where you've got that sensitive gut lining, it's actually the underlying mechanism is a dysfunction between the gut and the brain. So your gut has got all these like tingly nerves. And in IBS, it's like super exaggerated. So what we see is it's mostly when food gets to that last 1.5 meters in IBS where it causes a lot of the grief. So actually, it's not necessarily what you've just eaten. It could be what you've eaten about 5 or 6 hours ago. And it comes down, I mentioned this word, gastrocolic reflex. So when we put something in our tummy, what happens is that it then kicks on, it like pushes down and kicks this part, the lower part of our intestine, the food kind of pushes down to allow room. So if you put something in your tummy, then the food all moves down. And therefore, that can create some of that gut upset. So often when we're thinking in IBS, if people are eating something, the symptoms that they get instantly might actually have nothing to do with what they've just eaten, but something they've eaten a little while ago. So I do always recommend writing a food and symptom diary out for about 7 days. And then you can start to track if there's any sort of relationship between your symptoms and certain foods, or actually if it's just the mechanism of eating. Because if you've got IBS, a very sensitive gut, sometimes all types of food can trigger you because it's just activating your gut, particularly if you throw in a little bit of stress in there. Because remember that gut-brain axis, if you've got stress up here, in IBS it's even more exaggerated and it strangles your gut. So it's just not ready to eat. So doing some breathing exercises can help there.
I've got one more question I want to ask you, but here's one from at Gabby Logan. Oh, I wonder who that could be. you've just triggered a thought, actually. When I have to get up really early for something, say like 4:30, 5 o'clock for work, did the marathon a few weeks ago for the BBC, for example, I know now, I didn't in the past, but I know now I can't eat at that time. I have to wait about 3 hours maybe to the time I'd normally have my breakfast. If I eat almost straight away or within an hour, I find I have like a bloating for most of the day. What's that all about?
Yeah, it's a really interesting one, isn't it? So our gut kind of goes through this regeneration at night. And that's why, you know, having a 12, 13 hour fast, not waking up in the middle of the night and having a big meal, those sorts of things actually is thought to be beneficial because our gut lining sheds every 10 or so days. So there's that kind of renewal state going on. And therefore, if we wake up when our body's not used to waking up, so people who wake up at 4:30 every day, they could probably eat straight away at 5 and have no issue. But for you, your body's been tricked because it's not only does our human body have a circadian rhythm, that was sleep-wake cycle, but our gut and our gut bacteria also do. So actually you've woken up ahead of time. It wasn't ready. It's still kind of going through that cleaning process. And therefore it's like, whoa, what? I've been dumped with food. I'm not quite ready for it. And therefore your body has kind of that, oh, get it out. I'm not ready for this. And right. Doesn't do that proper digestion.
Is that why also people say if you do a lot of long haul travel, you should try and stick to meal times, like don't eat on the plane if it's not a meal time, because your body won't respond very well to it?
Yeah, that's partly one of the reasons. And the other thing that's really fascinating is what I call mile high IBS. So people may have experienced it before.
Yes,
where
I don't want to be crude, Megan, but on a plane sometimes, I think, do people think it's okay just to keep farting on a plane? I mean,
it's awful.
So if you go to sleep, you go up to the toilet in the middle of the night, it just feels like the whole place is filled with gas as well. And they can't all have bad gas.
Exactly. It's exacerbated up in the air because if you think it's this change in atmospheric pressure, right? So, you know, just like your water bottle expands in the air mm-hmm. and then you come back down, it crunches. The same mm-hmm. that happens with the air in our gut. So if we have a little bit of air in our tummy on the ground, and that happens because when the bacteria eat the fiber, which is very beneficial because they produce all these other chemicals, but they produce a bit of gas. It's a bit of a waste product, right? It's completely fine, inert, safe, all that sort of stuff. But that gas on the ground is just quite small. But in the air, what happens is it expands because of the change in the atmospheric pressure, just like our water bottle and things like that, the packet of chips, all that sort of kind of puffs out. So that happens in our gut, puts extra pressure on our gut, leads to things like the bloating, the tummy pain, some people, the change in poops, and then obviously the flatulence that has to get out somewhere. So actually, people who have that in a very bad way, what I recommend is reducing down certain types of foods about 24 to 48 hours before they go on a long haul flight. It can help reduce
Excellent
that gas down.
News. So loosely, what would those things be that you'd kind of drop from your diet for a long haul flight?
Interestingly, a lot of them are these prebiotic foods because the prebiotics, like I said, feed the gut bacteria. But then when the bacteria are fed, they produce those amazing chemicals that help with metabolism, all that sort of stuff. But also they produce that little bit of gas. So things like your legumes, your chickpeas, your butter beans, things like your cauliflower, your Brussels sprouts, those things we kind of know as gas forming. They're actually really, you know, so important to include. But like I said, in the air, the gas expands and therefore...
Give it a break for 24 hours before you fly, basically.
Absolutely. And then as soon as you landed, start to reintroduce.
Get on it. Just time for one more, which is from Jackie Whiting. And she says, I'm a 50-year-old woman. Snap, Jackie. How much is stomach bloating and wind diet or menopause related? Well, you've kind of addressed the menopause, but I wonder if there is an increase or a link in an increase with that, with the menopause. So you mentioned hormones before with the gut as well. And we know hormones change in the menopause.
Yeah. Annoyingly, it is that combination, right? So there is that increase in the risk of, or not risk, but the size of bloating, the amount of bloating that occurs because we know hormones, you know, whenever someone's on their period, right? You know, all your years, you notice you get more bloated, more fluid retention. So yes, annoyingly, hormones are incredibly powerful. But we also know that your diet can play a role in that. So if things like constipation is something that you're struggling with, so often people's bowels can slow up a little bit more when they're going through the menopause. Again, coming back to the hormones and the changes in your gut movement, then looking at the strategies to get on top of your constipation can really help relieve things like the bloating, because if you're backed up, that means more fermentation in your gut occurs, more gas is released. So thinking about that could be the underlying cause. Is it the case that actually, you know, you're not opening your bowels as much, or they're a little bit harder, and therefore that's kind of causing or triggering that bloating? So getting on top of that through the strategies we mentioned before.
Dr. Megan Rossi, I have a feeling this is going to be a very well listened to episode. I think it's a really important episode because it does worry me that people get so bombarded with so many messages that in the end they become a little bit like, oh God, I just can't be bothered. I'm just going to, you know, not do anything. And actually simple advice, whether it's the Super Six or variety in your vegetables, you know, just those simple messages are what people need to take away. So thank you. And just one more time, tell us the title of your two excellent books.
So Eat Yourself Healthy and Eat More, Live Well.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I'd love you to come back on one day, maybe in the next year or so, when I'm sure more will be, you know, kind of found out and developed in this area. And hopefully that message that you're trying to get mainstream will really, you know, get there, because it's so important, isn't it? And it's been great talking to you. Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Wow, I really hope that chat with Megan has helped to simplify some of the sometimes confusing information that's out there about our gut microbiome, and interestingly, how it can impact your mental health as well. And you heard Megan, we can still eat chocolate, very dark chocolate, obviously. But I love the concept of the Super Six. By grouping things, it feels a lot more manageable and you can get that variety into your diet every day, which is really, really important. That's the thing that I'm taking away anyway. If you want to hear more from Megan, head to theguthealthdoctor.com. Thank you so much to Spiritland Productions, and thanks to you as well for listening. Do let me know if you're enjoying these special expert episodes by leaving a review, and let me know if there are any other topics that you'd like us to focus on via the Midpointers Facebook group, or you can go to my Instagram account. And I'll catch you next week for more on all things The Midpoint.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.